The British Broadcasting Corporation is an institution unlike any other. It's a story during the Second World War. It's also the story of the British people. This was Britain's first total war, engaging the whole nation, and the wireless, as it was then, played a crucial role in it. Edward Stoughton's Auntie's War is a love letter to radio. Well, these were the years when Auntie, the BBC's enduring nickname, earned her reputation for bossiness. They were also a period of truly remarkable voices. Churchill's fighting speeches, De Gaulle's broadcasts for the Free French, J.B. Priestley, Ed Murrow, George Orwell, Richard Dimbleby and Vera Lynn. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, Edward Stoughton. Edward, good morning to you.
Good morning. Not a bad list, that, really, is it?
If you had to do your fantasy broadcasters.
Yeah, impressive.
Quite something. But when war broke out, the BBC was a bit of an old boys' club, really.
Well, it wasn't quite that. It was very sort of inward-looking. It was domestic. It was enjoying itself, entertaining the nation. And nobody'd ever had a radio war before. So they were suddenly hit by this extraordinary challenge, and they really were making it up as they went along. All sorts of unexpected challenges came out of the woodwork. I'll give you an example. For example, when Churchill declared that in the event of a German invasion in 1940, the country's church bells should be rung, and they should only be rung in those circumstances, BBC suddenly had to go through all its records and remove any records that included church bells, because if they played them, the nation would go into chaos. And one night the news ran short and somebody picked a disc off the pile and slipped it on, and sure enough, out came the sound of pealing bells, and there was pandemonium. Cabinet committees were set up, inquiries, all sorts of things. So all these unexpected challenges suddenly faced them in the world's first radio war.
And of course, this is the world's first radio war. I mean, it's difficult to think, isn't it, really? I mean, it is obviously a different age, but there's no internet, there's no social media, no. And news takes a lot, there's even no TV. So people gathered around the wireless to listen to the events. And I think one of the most evocative one is Churchill's speech in September 39. That's perhaps the first great radio event for the BBC in terms of war.
Well, there were countless moments that you listen to and you're taken straight back to one of those groups sitting around in a pub, or even we found some pictures of people walking in the street and just hearing the radio through a window, and they're all gathering around the hedge at the front garden and leaning in because something important's being talked about. The other crucial thing, of course, is it was the first time you could reach the other side. You could broadcast across enemy lines. The Germans woke up to that very quickly and used radio propaganda very effectively before they invaded Western Europe in May 1940. We took a bit more time to realise what potential that had, but when we did, things like the French service were absolutely crucial in preparing the way for D-Day and eventual victory.
And also, it was, you know, radio was... How difficult was it there to get people out? Because we think about Ed Murrow's reports, you know, American, yeah, coming over to Britain, and he set the standard for war reporting and was required listening.
Well, he's a really interesting figure because, of course, part of the sensitivity about all this was the degree to which reports should be censored. You weren't, for example, allowed to give the weather forecast because that was thought to give an advantage to German bombing raids and the people planning them. But we desperately wanted the Americans in on our side, and everybody realised that the American audiences wouldn't be persuaded if they thought their own reporters were being censored, if they thought they weren't getting a fair picture. So there are lots of memos inside the BBC archives where people say, well, frankly, when Murrow's talking about stuff, we've got to be a bit light in the censorship and let him say what he wants to say, because we've got to persuade the Americans that the message he's giving of a Britain under siege and a Britain standing up bravely is the truth. And he pushed the boundaries. So, for example, during the Blitz, he was the first person to persuade the authorities to let him stand on the top of Broadcasting House, which was very much a target for the Luftwaffe, and do a broadcast live into America during an air raid. Fantastically powerful stuff, and had a real impact on the outcome of the war, because those broadcasts did help persuade the American people that it was right to come in on Britain's side.
And he talks about Broadcasting House, the old Broadcasting House, yeah, being a target. I mean, it was hit by a bomb, and a bomb actually exploded, and there were fatalities.
Well, there's a most famous occasion when somebody, Bruce Belfrage, was actually reading the news when a bomb struck the building, and you can just hear on the recordings the tiny sort of judder, and he admitted afterwards that he was a bit shaken and needed, as he put it, a stiffener afterwards. So yeah, it was absolutely a target. And one of the things, the nice things, I'm very pleased about the production of this book, is that at the beginning of the book and the end paper, we've got a wonderful picture of Broadcasting House, all gleaming and shining new stone in 1932 when it was opened, and then one at the end on VE Day in 1945, just blackened and scarred by the impact of the war.
What was the attitude then of the British Prime Minister Churchill? We remember him for his great speeches, of course, and he came to love the medium. But as you said, it's the first war, the first total war that's been broadcast via radio, or had radio had an important effect on. How did he and the Ministry of War regard the BBC?
Churchill was suspicious of the BBC for historic reasons. He felt the BBC hadn't really given him enough of a voice during those difficult years in the 1930s when he was arguing that Hitler was a threat and that Britain had to prepare for war, and accusing the then government under Chamberlain of being appeasers and of essentially allowing Hitler his head. And he, as I say, didn't think that the BBC had really let him give voice to those opinions enough. So he was sceptical about it. There are lots of memos in which he's quite rude about it. That's one where he's put forward to him in Downing Street a proposal to give OBEs, I think, to a couple of BBC announcers, and he's scrawled, "What? Civilization will end when I give a BBC announcer an OBE." But, of course, he was, as you say, a brilliant broadcaster himself, even though very old-fashioned. I mean, one of the things that people learnt during the war is that intimate conversational broadcasting is what works best. Churchill wasn't like that at all. He was very sort of rhetorical in the way he spoke to people. And I think in the end he did come to realise the value of the medium. He did at one point try to take it over flatly. He issued a memo to his Minister of Information, who was called Duff Cooper, and said, "I want require you to take day-to-day editorial control of the BBC. Duff Cooper, I think, didn't really think that was a very good idea. He was defeated by the Board of Governors at the BBC, who told him to more or less to push off. And Churchill, I think, just sort of moved on to other stuff. He had so much to deal with. If the BBC was being truculent, he couldn't be that bothered with it.
And how important was the radio and the BBC broadcast for raising morale? I mean, we mentioned that the Nazis had Lord Haw-Haw, and they, because of their propaganda machine and Goebbels, were ahead of the game in so many ways on this one. But the BBC, with J.B. Priestley and the Postscripts, fought back, if you like.
Well, that was enormously important, and that was the immediate aftermath of Dunkirk, when it really did look, to any sane person actually, as if Britain was probably about to be invaded and was standing alone, and it was an existential moment, an existential threat to Britain. And Priestley's ability to create a sense of Britishness that was, he had this wonderful sort of northern accent, just a sort of lilt, as well as being very eloquent, and you felt he was speaking for the whole country in a sort of way. But I think beyond that, there's a very famous quotation from the news editor at the outbreak of war, and he sent a memo round when war broke out, and he said, I'll just quote it if I may, he said, "It seems to me that the only way to strengthen the morale of the people whose morale is worth strengthening is to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, even when the truth is horrible." And one of the things that emerges from the whole period is that actually truth is an incredibly powerful weapon of war, and that the Nazi version of propaganda, which was broadcasting falsehoods and unsettling people, could go so far, but no further. And in the course of the war, the BBC built a reputation as being the source of information that you could trust. And in occupied Europe, that was an enormously important factor in stiffening people's resolve against the Nazi occupation and eventually encouraging them to act when the moment came.
How logistically difficult was it for reporters to be out in the field? I mean, we're talking, obviously, prehistoric equipment, basically, lugging it around. I mean, how did the reporters get their stories, file their stories, and get the stories, if you like, broadcast back?
Well, it's a great story, that, in itself. And at the beginning of the war, the BBC really didn't have a reporting culture. It had a couple of, Richard Dimbleby and one or two others, out in the field with the British Expeditionary Force in France. but very thinly staffed, and they had to have recording cars in those days. You couldn't take a little bit of equipment with you. You had to have a sort of, you know, great bit. The original one was a recording laundry van converted, but they'd got to cars by then. So very, very cumbersome. I mean, Dunkirk, for example, one of the great events of British history, was effectively uncovered. There was nobody there to report it. But in the course of the war, and particularly during the years when Europe was occupied, so actually the only ways British reporters could report is either in the Middle East, where they could operate reasonably freely, or by going on forays over occupied Europe with the RAF, the engineers developed what they called a midget, which by our standards is a clumping great thing and is enormously heavy, but by theirs was very light. It was the size of a sort of old-fashioned gramophone recording disc. And you would literally put a record on it and record the sound like that. So it was pretty cumbersome, but that enabled them to get into the front line on D-Day and in the days that followed that, right up to the end of the war in 1945. And the reporting then is really, I think, staggering. I mean, wonderful stuff and incredible bravery. You know, people, for example, parachuted in with the paratroopers into Arnhem and swam across the Rhine when the troops were encircled to escape. They risked their lives in bombing raids. They dropped in gliders behind enemy lines on D-Day. And some of the material is just really memorable.
I mean, this is obviously the birth of the modern war correspondent as well. With, I mean, Ed Morrow is a touchstone to a lot of broadcasts as well. But, you know, going in with the troops, because previously war corresponding had been done, you know, sent that back months later from the Boer War, going all the way back there and from the lines. But this is really the birth of the modern war correspondent, the war photographer, and we think of, you know, of these as starting with those drops into Arnhem and on the beaches in D-Day.
And also, I think, technologically, the birth of something close to live broadcasting in the way we understand it at the moment. I mean, as soon as the troops were advancing in Western Europe after D-Day, the BBC started getting trucks over that could transmit live. And you could get reports back really very, very quickly. And if there was a big thing happening, you know, the schedules would be cleared and the BBC would go live with the announcement and live with the story. So it was the birth of all sorts of things. I think if you'd been in the offices of War Report, which was the main programme putting out news towards the end of the war, one night in late 1944, it would have felt like being in the headquarters of, I don't know, CNN or something today. It was that sort of operation that was being unleashed.
How did the BBC handle the celebrations of Victory in Europe and Victory in Japan Day then? Because the mood of the nation must have been ecstatic.
It was, and I think they'd become quite good at that. They'd become quite good at capturing the national mood, and because, as you said earlier, people had become accustomed to seeing the wireless as the way they listened and understood the world and the way the war came to them, they were absolutely central to those occasions. And I think the BBC's benefited hugely from that ever since. You know, that is sort of in the collective unconsciousness, if you like, and is reflected in the way that people turn to the BBC still today when there are great events of that kind.
And presumably, you know, after the end of the war, the Second World War had basically schooled a generation of BBC reporters who were quite active and willing to get out in the field and start doing proper journalism then.
I think, I mean, this is perhaps, I think I'm putting this too high. I think the sort of modern broadcasting culture was created by the BBC during that period. I think it's easy to demonstrate that the idea of international broadcasting and of the World Service and all that came very directly from that period. So I think we have a huge amount it sounds odd saying should be grateful to a period of war, but I think the broadcasting culture, which I've been working as a broadcaster 40 years, in which I've been lucky enough to grow up, has its roots, absolutely, in the lessons that were learnt, the technology that was developed, the kind of ethic of being there, seeing things, getting the sound or the pictures if it's television, giving the listener or the viewer a feel of what it's like to be on the ground. All of that goes back to the best of BBC broadcasting during World War II.
What was it like researching and getting the information and getting the pictures for the book as well? That must have been an interesting experiment.
Well, the BBC archives in Caversham are fantastic in the sense that they are huge. They haven't been digitised or anything of that kind. You're very reliant on the archivists, who are wonderful, but you say, you know, I'd like everything on censorship in May 1940, and they disappear off to some dusty corner of the building and come back with a dusty old file. And it's full of... The files are full of surprises, which makes researching great fun. I mean, for example, I came across one in the personnel file of a man called Winfred Vaughan Thomas, who's a very famous war correspondent. There was a memo from the administration department which said, you must return the two stopwatches which you drew when you joined OBs, outside broadcast, and failed to return when you joined the war reporting unit. I thought, why on earth has anybody bothered to keep this rather sort of trivial, fussy bit of bureaucratic nonsense in the file? And then I looked at the date and realised it was sent to him on the night before he marched into Rome with the victorious Americans liberating the city in 1944. And the sort of admin officer's obviously aware that it's a bit silly, this, because he's put at the bottom, P.S. it's been very good to hear so much of you on the air at the moment. So it's those little sort of things which give you a glimpse of what I think it's the things that people write in the margins that tell the truth very often. You know, that's what they're really thinking. And there's lots of that stuff. So it was, in that sense, it was terrific fun. And also, you know, it's... I mean, I work in a world of words, so reading stuff that's well-written and beautifully crafted is actually just rather inspiring. It's a great pleasure.
I just love the fact that, you know, the accounts and the expenses people will have you wherever you are in the world.
Yeah, they will. Absolutely.
And I think the other one of the surprising things is the fact that, you know, Vera Lynn, Dame Vera Lynn, was regarded as bad for morale at the beginning.
She was. That was, I think, the more pompous, of which there were many at the BBC, as we said, at the top. There's a wonderful note in the Governor's Minutes, which says simply, I think, about her programme, sincerely yours, popularity noted, vulgarity deplored, which...
Well, she's well known for her vulgarity as Dame Vera Lynn, let's face it. That's why she's not on I'm a Celeb anymore.
but I think actually that what behind that there is an important point, which is that things were moving so fast and practical demands were so acute, and that the need to adapt to the way things were developing was so pressing, that actually it was the people making programmes that really drove stuff. And you get a sense of the gods, you know, the governors and the Director General and people all chatting away at the top and discussing things in a polite way with the government and so forth, but actually the real work is going on in the newsrooms with the programme makers, and they're the ones who are making the programmes that we all that were so well remembered. And by the time that they were discussed in the Board of Governors, they might well think it was vulgar, but frankly it didn't matter anymore because everyone else was saying how much they loved them.
I'd love, hopefully, that the idea that people make the programmes will still be going and we don't have...
It's a nice thought, isn't it?
Then think goodbye committees. The book is called Auntie's War, the BBC during the Second War. It's by Edward Staunton. It's published by Doubleday. What's your next plan then for are you going to be doing another book? Are you going to be following up? Or
I'm actually doing a history of a publishing history at the moment, which is similar in that it takes you back to same sort of period, and also is one of those enjoyable things that lets you reflect on the interplay between the institution and the nation, which is what this project in a way did. You know, it's watching how a big institution reflects and reacts to the changes around it that makes these things fascinating, I think. It makes that sort of social history fascinating.
Indeed, and the Second World War, if you like, cemented Auntie's place as the British people's listening, yeah, viewing for the next 40 years or 50 years, you could argue.
Well, I think the other interesting thing about that is I think it also is the reason that we have such an incredibly vibrant radio culture in this country, because there was actually television. The BBC running a very expensive, it has to be admitted, but it was running a quite successful television series immediately before war broke out, and they closed that down because they didn't think that it merited the resources in the emergency of wartime, and focused everything in radio. And I think that put radio at the heart of our culture in in a way that's still reflected in the quality of our radio broadcasting and the love of radio you find in Britain today.
Indeed, and hopefully it will continue and stand the test in time and weather the attacks of such interlopers as the internet and social media. And
doing pretty well in that regard, I think. Sometimes better than... I started my working life in television, and I think television news particularly has been much more battered than radio. Radio is oddly very well placed to take advantage of, different platforms and things.
And that's another subject which we take in, and at least another ad, the programme in itself. The book is called Auntie's War, the BBC During the Second World War. It's published on Doubleday. It's by Edward Staunton. Edward, thank you so much for your
time
today.
Great pleasure. Thank you.